Hello and welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Coramdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down and talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about pixelated souls.
Pixelated souls. What?
Everything's pixelated, even my soul now. Is that
plastic,
what you're saying?
Plastic, liquid, and pixelated.
We're about to discuss it. Yeah, I mean, that's what these two articles are arguing. This is an article in First Things from two professors at Furman University. And they want to make the case that, yes, your soul is pixelated. So let me explain where this episode is headed. This is basically an article of political philosophy. And as you know, on this podcast, one of the things we try to think a lot about is how the church relates to culture and how Christianity connects to the particular questions our culture is asking. And all of us know that we're in a moment where sort of the consensus that holds American culture together is kind of fraying. This is why Trump was an interesting phenomenon. This is what you're seeing in sort of all of the fragmentation over various issues of race, gender, all kinds of stuff like that, the sort of increasing polarization between right and left. This is all an expression of a culture that seems like it's fraying. And so anytime someone sort of seeks to analyze that and say, hey, why is that happening in our social fabric? And what does the gospel have to say to that? We sort of want to pay attention to that article and go, okay, that's interesting. So these two authors, Jenna and Benjamin Story from Furman University, here's the case they want to make. And the way they make it is a little bit involved and might read better for those of you who are super familiar with political philosophers like John Locke. If you haven't read a ton of John Locke lately, we're just going to skip the first couple pages of this article and tell you what case they're making.
So for guys like me, I had to go back and reread the first couple of paragraphs.
Yeah. What they're saying is, hey, so by the way, in this podcast, we're going to use the word liberalism. And what we mean by that is in the political sense. So sometimes when we speak of liberalism, we contrast it with conservatism. And so you might think theologically of like a theological conservative versus a theological liberal. In the political tradition, liberalism is what we all embrace. It's the sort of foundation of American democracy. It's the idea that human freedoms and human rights make up the foundation of society. And so it's sort of the when you think political liberalism, think the Declaration of Independence, think the American founding fathers, sort of the things we've all come to embrace, at least in our political tradition, broadly speaking. What these authors want to argue in this article is the liberal tradition in politics is based on the sense that within every one of us, there are sort of two competing allegiances. There's our allegiance to our religion and there's our allegiance to our country. And that, you know, liberalism was sort of built on how do we make trade-offs between those two allegiances. To think about it another way, if you think back to the history of Western Europe and all the wars of religion that took place in the 16th and 17th centuries, you know, the continent was almost torn apart by are we Protestant or are we Catholic? And so finally, sort of the way those all were put to rest was, hey, let's just figure out a way where we can be whatever religion we want and where our religion doesn't have to map onto our politics. And so what you saw in England and in America was this approach to politics that said, hey, let's say, great, if you're a Catholic, if you're a Protestant, if you're a Baptist, a Methodist, an Anglican, whatever, that's fine. You can be whatever you want religiously, but you have to embrace to these sort of common ideals that bind us together in society. So they're saying classic liberalism was just attempting to help us navigate those two competing claims, the claim of the church on our lives and the claim of society on our lives. And it worked for people who had that problem. But now we don't have that problem anymore. They want to make the case that traditional people were bifurcated souls is kind of the language they use. They had a part of their soul that was loyal to God, and they had a part of their soul that wanted to be loyal to their people or their country. And so we had to figure out how to solve that problem.
Bob, could you just quick speak to why that was the problem? Why, as you think of how people were formed at that time, why were these kind of the competing things?
Well, the two most grounding and formative influences in everyone's life were the people they came from and the religion they believed, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, think about my ancestors are all Norwegian. So they were, you know, they were Norwegian in their culture and they were Lutheran in their religion. And those things were very closely tied together. There were no Norwegian Catholics. I mean, not that I know of. It's like, if you even go to the parts of the country where they were, that were settled by Norwegian and Swedish people, there's Lutheran churches everywhere because that was their tradition. But if you go to the parts of the country that were settled by Irish, it's usually Catholic or Italians or so you had these part, you know, these were your things. Who's your people and what was your religious tradition? And so if we're going to have a political, you know, think about the foundings of America. If we're going to have Irish people and Italians and Norwegians and Swedes, and we're going to all make a country together. Well, you know, we start out with the colonies of, well, certain colonies are Catholic and certain colonies are Protestant and certain colonies are right. And mm-hmm. the deal we all made was, okay, let's figure out how everybody can be what they want to be, but we can all be Americans. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's helpful to, and again, to kind of tie it to some of the things we've been talking about of those formative institutions that set identity. And why these things mattered. And this is why religious freedom was such a front and center point of liberalism. Why in many ways, as we're going to see here as we continue to talk, why religious freedom in many ways doesn't even make sense anymore.
Okay, so the case these authors are going to make is, hey, it doesn't make sense anymore because we're not those kind of people. Now we are, Dusty, to use your pixelated souls. Now we are pixelated souls. What they mean is we're pulled in a dozen different directions. We're totally dissipated in our energies. We're formed by a dozen different kinds of allegiances and interests. And, we are pressured in so many ways. I think of what Charles Taylor uses, the language of cross pressured, that we live in this world that's sort of pressing on us from all these different directions. And what happens is that we have become, chaotic. Here's how they describe it. Our public square resounds with a cacophony of rivals whose conflicts are not binary, but chaotic, and whose claims on us are ever shifting. Americans are struggling to hold things together. Pulled in a dozen different directions, we are unable to subject our days to any clear purpose. We move through time reactively, dispersing the self as we go. The screen is the command center from which we navigate such days. It's also the 21st century public square and weaves the public contest of authorities into our daily lives. Simply picking up our devices subjects our attention to dispersion. Email reminds us of professional obligations. YouTube promises diverting relief. Twitter beckons us into the realm of reputational combat. Instagram pressures us to calibrate our movements against those of our friends. Toggling among these competing icons becomes the incessant rhythm of our consciousness. Our vision pixelates. We forget what we're after. We lose sight of ourselves. The constant efforts to reform ourselves to align with the latest imperatives leave us exhausted, at a loss for what to say, how to dress, where to look, who we are. The contours of ourselves have little chance to firm up through the workings of habit. Instead, they shift and blur.
I mean, I would just summarize that as, to use a food analogy, on the farm, you eat meat and potatoes and whatever vegetables in the garden, right?
Yeah.
Now, I think this fits. Now we're at the buffet and we're like, oh, you can have steamed carrots and ice cream? Like, sure. So like, I think what he's saying here, correct me if I'm wrong, is like, we have to pivot. Our new public square is we have to pivot into all these spaces that were so blurry.
Yes. And it has a dissipating effect on ourself. So to Chris's point, it used to be that within the sort of limited obligations you have to town, vocation, family, church, those were very formative institutions. This goes back to a podcast we did a few weeks ago where we were talking about how social media sort of dissipates our allegiances. So because we're at this buffet, to use your language, Dusty, our self doesn't firm up in the same way. And we're sort of like, we're one person on Instagram, we're one person on Twitter, we're one person at our work, we're one person at home. We don't know who we are or how to really establish any deep and grounded sense of self. And so we're just sort of like different versions of ourselves on different days almost.
Yeah. And he calls it an acting self.
Yeah.
Especially on the social media realm.
And the things that he lists out there, another word you could use is distractions. Like so many of those things are just ways we distract ourselves. And so we are this pixelated self because we're just so, and maybe we can say this, we're formed by distraction. And distraction is not a set, firmed, consolidated reality in existence. It is pixelated or chaotic, the words that you've used, Bob. So this, in some ways, they're getting at the formation of distraction and how that has affected us politically.
Okay, so we're not probably saying anything that to our listeners is provocative or new, but here's the point these authors want to make that I think is profound. They say, okay, so if it's true that we're sort of pixelated now, the argument we keep having politically is which version of liberalism should we embrace? Should we, you know, like how do we fix the things that are fraying and tearing us apart? How do we put that back together? Even today, I read an article from Ross Douth at the New York Times about, what's the new kind of consensus pulling together conservative Catholics and Hispanics who are Pentecostals and evangelical, you know, is there like a new consensus that can take forward sort of conservative movement politics? The people on the left are asking the same question in different ways. These writers are saying, dummies, wrong question, because you can't, the point is the way people are now, liberalism doesn't answer the questions they're asking. They're no longer pulled between their allegiance to their people and their religion. Now they're pulled in 12 or 25 different directions. And the prescription that liberalism was designed to solve, right? The symptoms that it was designed to treat don't exist anymore. And so they say it this way. No prominent political figure has yet devised a prescription likely to restore our health. In recent years, arguments about liberalism have preoccupied us, but the remedies suggested in these debates, from recommitment to the political principles of liberalism to Benedict option type strategies of withdrawal, can work only for people who already have their lives together. Such suggestions ignore the psychopolitical malady of our time. I love what, so the case they're making is, yeah, let's stop arguing about Benedict option or like a new religious right. Those things only work for people that already have their lives together. What we have now is a society of people who don't know who they are and we don't have our lives together. And so this isn't going to work.
Yeah. There's no consensus and there's nothing to preserve.
And as they say earlier in the article, that the mechanisms of traditional liberalism were compromise,
yes,
and a willingness to kind of give and take and give up certain things, where now in our world, that is an affront to my identity. That's a threat. And so there is no place for compromise.
So here's another way to say what they're saying is in classic liberal thinking, you already had a grounded identity. And the question was just, hey, what rights do I have to give up? And what rights are you willing to give up for us to live together in society, mm-hmm. right? And yes, they're saying now, if I don't have even a grounded sense of identity, now most of our political debates are about establishing a sense of identity. Well, I don't need to give you any rights because this is who I am. And darn it, you're stepping on my identity by claiming that I have to compromise something. Mm. And so the fights are different because we're having the wrong fight is kind of what they're saying. And I think that's interesting because we've had so many conversations on this podcast about the Benedict's option, about various prescriptions for Christians' life in a democratic society, right? And there, I think this is not another version of the same argument. They're making a different case, which is, yeah, maybe the whole fabric of political liberalism is ill-equipped to speak to who we are today and the problems we're going to have.
What also is interesting, they highlight, so the example of some of the protests we've seen the past couple of years, and in some ways protesting legitimate wrongs, like, you know, social injustice and racism and various things. But where that's coming from is not the same place of the protests of 50 years ago. I mean, this country was founded on the right to protest and to petition. And so there's a long tradition way back into, you know, the pinnacle of traditional liberalism where there was protest, but where that protest was coming from and what it was trying to accomplish versus today superficially looks the same, but isn't underneath. And so this goes back to your point, Bob, where we start talking about these things, thinking that we're talking about a traditional liberal framework of protest, and that's not what's happening whatsoever. And so we're going to, when we talk about these things, the way we're going to even engage and think through what do we do about all these cries for social justice that, are happening. If we're kind of using those old definitions and old frameworks, it's going to have no impact. And really we're going to be, it's almost kind of like the conversation is just has shifted so much. It's going to be unintelligible at some point.
Let me read 3 or 4 sentences from the article. You have to hang with the language here because it's philosophical, but they say this. Rights claims were designed as tools of practical negotiation to be used by people engaged in concrete social projects they wished to protect. Such people could be brought to see the wisdom of granting others the same latitude they sought for themselves. Okay, so those 2 sentences are what you just said, Chris, that classic political bargaining is, hey, I need this, you need that. How the Senate and the House used to work is, hey, I want this for my district, you want that for your district. How can we come together and, you know, get what we want by giving up a little and sort of coming to the bargaining table? They go on to say, dispersing souls, by contrast, do not come to the bargaining table with something to gain and something to give. Certain that they want something, but uncertain exactly what it is, they seek to secure their rights as a way of securing themselves. And this is, I think, what we're missing in sort of even the current conversation about religious freedom, right? All of us Christians are like, man, we need to preserve religious freedom. True, we do. And some people think, well, let's, you know, what do we need to give up to the other side for them to give us religious freedom? And these guys are saying, yeah, that's not the game we're playing anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
People aren't coming to the bargaining table with like, oh, okay, I'll give up this and you give up that and let's all just get along. Now, all those disputes about rights are ways of securing people's identity. And so even think about how this maps onto, you know, questions of gender or of sexual preference or of, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity laws, right? This is why this conversation is fraught with landmines, is because these are not seen as, okay, well, let's all just give up a little bit of our rights and all get along in society. It's seen as, nope, you're stepping on my identity and heck no, I'm not giving that up to you. You don't have a right to practice your religion if it says something I don't appreciate about what my identity is or about what I feel my identity is.
And this is why, as Christians, we should not be surprised that the appeals to religious liberty just don't carry the same effect and same weight. And even if you're trying to speak to the benefit, hey, we're not just talking about Christianity, we're talking about, you know, Muslims and Jews and all religions, that appeal to sort of plurality sounded great 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now it doesn't.
Yeah. All right, lead dudes. So in light of this, to use one of their lines, they say the most successful among us learn to surf the currents of the attentional seascape. So let's just say let's just take their word for it. That's where we're headed. That's where we are. What does that mean for us as Christians in the church, and especially for you guys as you are leading, you know, at the helm of leading churches over the next couple decades? What are you hopeful about? What are you thinking about in light of this reality?
Let me read the last paragraph of the article because I think it's what sets up that question for me. They say, good doctors pay attention to the particular patient on the table. Those who wish to help their country now must find a political prescription that will help dispersing souls reimagine themselves. Only then will such souls be ready to take part in a renewed political life. So they're basically saying, if you're a doctor, figure out what patient you're working on. And I think that call is the call for the church. That's why this article interested me, because I think what the connection it makes for me, Dusty, is I think a lot of churches are still operating as though we're where we were 50 years ago, where it's like, hey, people are, they're looking to come to a church. They're looking to hear a good sermon. They want some community and some friendships. And so let's just provide all those things. And then we're doing our job as the church. I think this article, and not just this article, but it's just another voice saying, hey, we need to ask who are the people we're trying to make disciples of? And what does it mean for them to become disciples? We need to sort of go back to ground zero, first principles. And if it's true that we're increasingly trying to make disciples of people who are dispersed and dissipated in their sense of self, the issues of gospel identity, the issues of groundedness in practices, spiritual disciplines, the basic, hey, what does it mean for me to know Christ, to be committed to a people, to a church community, and to actually learn how to do conflict, how to build healthy friendships, These are the kinds of things that need to preoccupy us as pastors and Christian leaders. These are the kinds of questions we need to be asking. If we're not asking any of those questions, I think we're just going to recycle ministry strategies from 40 and 50 years ago, or even from 20 years ago, that just aren't going to have the same effect, not because the Bible isn't true or because the gospel isn't true, but because the people that we're trying to disciple are different kinds of people. To use the language of this article, we're not dealing with people who are deeply formed by traditional institutions and obligations and just need to see that Jesus is the way to salvation. But we're dealing with people who are disconnected and dispersed and widely scattered in their attention and in their sense of identity, and who need to be grounded. And we need to help them come to know what it means to be known by God in Christ and to build a certain kind of character.
I don't remember when we did this podcast, but we did it on Mark Sayer's book, Reappearing Church.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he highlighted was the need within spiritual formation to return to places like the Proverbs that help form people in a way of life, a particular way of life. And so to just add, I would completely agree with everything you just said, Bob, of starting from, in many ways, ground zero, not of just biblical literacies in the way of content, but spiritual formation and basic spiritual practices that begin to consolidate identity and root you in a community and institution. And I think sometimes as the church, we sort of skip over and miss the way that the Proverbs play into that, and some of the just these practical, grounded life things, skills, relationships, conflict resolution, like things that our culture just no longer builds into us because of we're so pixelated and dissipated, as this article says, that there are certain things that I think the church just can't rely on the culture to sort of have established, and then just add, like you were saying, just add Christ to that, and to in some ways gospelize that thing, that we have to even just build the basic function, like how to resolve conflict as a human being and not as someone who's on, you know, ranting on Facebook, or how to stay present in relationship through conflict, or, you know, how to deal with the mess of an institution, you know, those kinds of things that just aren't present in our world anymore. And they don't really learn that the church kind of becomes a place that disciples that. So I'll admit, when I read this article, I was thinking, wow, this in some ways maps onto some areas that I'm already kind of thinking about, but also presses deeper into areas where I don't necessarily think about with discipleship, because I assume that that's kind of basic life skill that they've learned in the world, and we can't assume that anymore.
Okay, so let's use a practical example. Let's dial back the clock to last year, when Trump was running against Biden, right? And here's an example of what I saw. Like Chris, to your point, the classic political liberalism was a very respectable kind of give and take in debate. So my first job coming out of college, I worked for my uncle when he was running for U.S. Congress, and I lived with Jim Abner, who was a retired U.S. senator. He had served in the Senate in the 80s, and man, he was retired. You go to the grocery store and people called him senator. You know, he's like 82 years old maybe at that time, and just well respected by everyone. But I mean, he had this deep sense of like honor. He would get phone calls from Democrats every day I would answer the phone, and it was like that's the Democratic senator from South Carolina calling just to say hi, like just checking in. Like there was just this collegial, familial, these are guys that I gave and take with and debated, and we came to conclusions and worked together on things, even though we had very different paradigms, right? So that's like, I loved the sense of like, oh man, the Senate is a very honorable institution where people sort of, there's a lot of give and take, and you got to work with people to get things done. Then what so you sort of think about what it looks like to be trained in political engagement in that kind of a world, okay? Now go to, no disrespect to you, Travis, but people who haven't experienced that kind of a political world. All the political engagement they've experienced is Facebook and Twitter in 2020, right? Where it's just like double down, argue with people, defend your point of view, call people stupid. If you're voting for the wrong person, you're an idiot. That's what our, and so I had this experience, Chris, last year where I was like, I would pull up Facebook. I would see people from our church that I'm like, I actually really respect that person's walk with the Lord. Why are they saying that on Facebook? Like, what are they doing right here on Facebook? And you just go like, oh, it's not that they're, it's that they haven't been, there's been no training, no equipping, no formation in how do you respectfully disagree with someone about politics? Nor is that expectation culturally anymore. No one in the society expects that you should be able to reasonably disagree. So when I was, you know, to go back in my story, when I was a kid, if I would have interacted that way with someone, I probably would have gotten in trouble because my parents have been like, that's not respectful, right? But now with, and I don't want to blame it on social media. I'm just saying that's the matrix in which you start to see these things. And that's just one example of the kinds of places where it's like, okay, now the church has to think not just about how do we make disciples, but man, how do we help people have political conversations and disagree with people? Because that's, they would have learned that in a healthy family, or they might have learned that in a civics class in high school, or they might have learned that by living with a senator or knowing someone in politics, but not anymore. You know, that's just not the world we live in. And so that, to me, that's just a practical example of the thing you're talking about. The church has to rethink its mission, not just in terms of how do we help people walk with Christ, but how do we help people engage in the world in all kinds of different ways that reflect Sermon on the Mount kinds of virtue.
Yeah. Being respectful in a world where respect seems at best quaint, and at worst, to be respectful is actually to propagate violence against someone's identity, or, you know, silence is violence, or, you know, that kind of thing, where respect is not seen as a virtue anymore. I mean, it's just that the game has changed. The game has changed. And this article, I think, highlights that in a very, not necessarily saying anything completely new, but applying it, like mapping it on in some, I think, very profound ways.
Yeah, and I think the implications are for the church of just like, yep, we need to rethink what does discipleship look like if this is true? You know, how do we decide? So to use the language of the article, how do we disciple pixelated souls? And Dusty, this is kind of like the language of integration, right? Or of like wholeness. How do we help people have a wholeness to their soul if what we're handed is a person whose soul is very dissipated and not sort of unified and centered? And so, you know, centering language can sound really therapeutic and, you know, mumbo jumbo, but I really think that's one of the things the gospel does, is to reorient us and ground us and give us a center. And that, maybe that's something we could have assumed in the past that people already came with. But I'm suggesting that I think now that's more and more our calling as the church, is how do we help one another become whole people, integrated people, where mind, will, emotions, affections are oriented around the kingdom of God, and where we have the honest sort of openness toward one another that takes.
I do think it's helpful what they say about the Benedict option, even though it's just one line and it's not necessarily real charitable to the Benedict option, but how they say that it can only work for people who already have their lives together. Because I do know of people who would be listening to this particular podcast saying like, yep, that's why we're just gonna, you know, hide your kids, hide your wife kind of approach, right? Like, let's just go the Benedict option and bail. And that's not going, while it might preserve something, it's not going to engage anything or change the culture of restlessness and pixelation that we find ourselves in, which is actually the world that your kids are going to have to grow up and engage. So just running and hiding isn't going to be the best option either.
Well, and to take it in a more existential direction or a more individual direction, what you just said is true. The answer for Christians is not, well, we're just going to grow up in a pixelated world. The answer is, no, we're called by Christ to be whole people and to help others be whole people. And so the point of this article and this podcast is not, well, we're dealing with a pixelated world, so I guess we're all just going to live dissipated lives. The point is, nope, we've got to learn. We've got to take this as an invitation from the Lord. How do we become integrated, whole, healthy souls? And how do we help other people, starting with our own families, but then the people that God has called us on mission to, our neighbors, our friends, the people down the street, across the block, across the backyard? How do we help people become whole integrated souls. That is our calling. And that's fun work, but it's also kind of new work in terms of the kind of mission that we're called to, because again, in the past, we might have just been able to assume, well, people are coming to us pretty fully formed in some of these traditional social institution kind of ways. And that is probably not the case anymore. And so it means our work does change, and our calling as the church, though it remains the same, has to take a different shape in order to disciple people.
I also think people were coming to the church from a really relationally grounded place in generations past. And now they're coming to us more lonely, more restless, less rooted. And so I also think there's some fun work to be had in the church there. I think the church is going to end up being a place of rootedness, stability, less anxiety than all of my, all the feeds that are coming into my phone and tablet.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We always love to hear from you, the listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topic ideas, send us an email, podcast@cdomaha.com. And we'll see you again next Wednesday for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.